Hi, this is Ken with Hacker Public Radio, and we're up here at the exhibition area, where the Hardware Hacking Village. And I'm talking to?
Jan Harper.
And Jan, what are you doing here today?
Do you know, I'm just looking after this lovely stall, and this stall is for Raspberry Pi. And a gentleman called Pete Lomas is here today, and he is one of, well, basically, he's the inventor of the Raspberry Pi. He did the board and all the circuits. And we've got a few to sell. And Pete's not here because he's actually giving a talk to a group at the moment, so he'll be back soon. I'm sure you can speak to him then. So that's what I'm doing.
And are you enjoying the show?
I am, actually, because this is my first time, and I'm not really technical. I'm here because the day I saw the Raspberry Pi, I knew I wanted it in primary schools. So that's why I got involved in this. I think this is the cheap, accessible way to get kids into programming. So that's why I got fired up. I can't program myself, so apparently I'm going to be taught really soon, and I'm going to learn from scratch and do Scratch, just like all the children in the school. And I'm going to go on that journey with them, but I just think this has the potential to move children away from just being simply consumers of products to creators themselves. So one of the things I'm looking at is seeing if we can get some sort of a virtual European library of games and programs that children have created so that they can exchange amongst themselves and get some ownership of the knowledge that they can have.
Are you a teacher yourself? What's your interesting kid?
No, I'm not a teacher, but I work ICT in education. So at the moment I'm working with newly converted academy schools that have moved away from local authority funding and management, who now have their own funding and can look at their ICT strategy in a different way, in a more open way. That combined with the government now looking at the curriculum in a wider way. So that's where I'm coming from with the Pi. So my sort of day job is I would look at a school strategy, see what they're spending, where they need to put their spend, how it matches up with their educational needs, and where the value is, and that kind of stuff.
Thank you very much for being here, and thank you very much for supporting the Raspberry Pi community. Hi, this is Ken here. I'm wandering around upstairs in the hardware section, and I've come across
Ben. Who's I am building the Prusa Mendel 3D printer.
Wow, it looks essentially like a it looks like it's got it's a, like an A-frame. Can you basically describe it for our listeners, please?
If you think of a Toblerone that's been squished up, has that same shape of a triangular prism. It's mostly metal rods connecting together with plastic on the joints. Lots of nuts and bolts everywhere. And it's actually a very simple machine when you get down to it. It's just something that moves in several directions and squeezes plastic out like a squeezing toothpaste out of a toothpaste holder.
The components seem to be just regular threaded rod. These brackets here holding the things together seem to be extruded from a what could be a 3D printer.
Once upon a time, yes.
So this is the idea of you make a printer to make a printer to make a printer.
Yes, there's lots of work going on to refine the build so that fewer and fewer bought parts are used and more printed parts are used, so that we can get to a point where the printer works comfortably, but with most of the parts just being secondhand from someone else building them for you.
And how much would a printer like this cost you?
If you source it yourself, you can probably get it cheaper, but if you buy an entire kit, you're probably not looking at more than £500.
Okay, and if you buy the kit, do you get an instruction manual how to put it together?
You get everything that we've got here today, which is the instruction manual, all the parts, all the pieces, the electronics, a small reel of plastic, and basically enough to get going with.
Okay, so what's your motivation for doing this?
I think that it's an excellent tool to have nowadays. It can, because we don't really do woodworking much anymore. We don't have metalwork as a core subject. People will take it up, but these can be used without having that level of skill required to make something. It's about making something digital into the real world, making it physical. And I think getting these into the hands of especially children, but of anyone, to understand that this is how simple it can be. because I think that this printer should be able to be built over the course of a weekend just by me. So with people helping, we should get it finished even quicker.
I must say it's causing quite a stir around. People coming down to our booth have been using it as an excuse to go upstairs and see how far you are with this printer. But it's basically, I'm just standing here, there's as a mechanical engineering student myself, there's nothing too scary that I see. It seems to be an instruction manual. He's got the requisite beard that you need for constructing something like that. So where would somebody go if they wanted to order one of these? Are you running a company yourself? Or
I don't. I'm trying to do more of a pay it forward motif where I'll go and help someone build it with the knowledge that, well, with the mandate on them for them to go and do exactly the same to someone else.
Kind of similar to our own thing here in Hacker Public Radio. If you're listening, we expect one contribution a year, no pressure.
Yes, no, it's a very positive thing. And I don't have any part or say or financial gain in this. I just think it is something that people need to get hold of and just know it exists and can be attained by anyone, really.
Okay, where should you send our listeners to? What's the website?
The key problem is that there are lots of people selling different kits.
Yeah.
This particular kit was done by Next Day Rep Wrap, I believe. Next Day Rep Wrap, and the kit seems to be fairly complete. Plastic parts seem okay. We've yet to test the electronics, but it seems like it's a complete all-in-one box.
Okay, and it's got the GNU logo on the front and GPL V3, so yeah, that can't be bad.
The entire design is
okay. I might drop around later on during the week, see how you're getting on.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the interview. Bye-bye. Hi, this is Ken. I'm up at the Hackerspace, I think, on the third floor at OGCamp 12, and I've just come up to talk to Lee about?
About digital embroidery.
Digital embroidery. Please tell me what I'm looking at here.
Well, what you're looking at the moment is a Brother embroidery machine, a PR650, which is a six-needle multicolour machine. It is running proprietary software at the moment, but I'm here hopefully to meet up with people who may know other people or get into the realms of an open source version for digitising images and turning them into embroidery patterns.
Can you walk me through what it looks like? Essentially, it's a sewing machine. I see six different colors at the back. They're all fed through a warp down through six different feeders and essentially 60 different needles. Would that be correct?
That's exactly right. And then it takes a hoop arrangement, which you put the garment into to position it. And it's got a programmable touch screen. You can also plug into it with a laptop or USB, and essentially the whole machine just moves its arm arrangement around to make the stitching of the pattern.
So you could then upload some sort of image. What sort of formats does it take?
Well, it'll take any graphical format, GIF, PNG, JPEG, etc., but they do need converting into stitch patterns, which is I have some proprietary software for that, but that's the link I'm looking for, is to have that open source version of something that will take ordinary graphics files and turn them into stitch patterns.
I'll tell you what you need to do is get Linus's wife to buy one. You heard about his sewing machine?
No, I haven't.
His wife had a sewing machine and it wouldn't work with Linux, so he wrote drivers to get it working.
Wow.
So that's the key. Make sure
for you. Yes.
You need to find out what one she's using.
Okay.
And it's the image, does it have to be a particular quality or anything?
No, not especially, but it does sometimes take a lot of touching up to get the stitch pattern right after you've got an image. So it can take a bit of hand manipulation.
Okay, and I'm looking at an OGCamp t-shirt and it's got the words Mike the Bee and half a word and test pattern, and basically it's for stitching logos. This would be ideal for doing, if you had t-shirts to do embroidered on it.
Absolutely, yeah.
How much would a machine like this set you back?
They're not cheap.
I suspected that, all right.
About £6,000.
Wow. My sister-in-law has one, but it's only got one needle on it, but you can change the color and it continues to go over, so that was considerably cheaper, but obviously more work.
Right, exactly. That's the thing. This is a sort of semi-industrial version in the sense that you can make more complex patterns without having to keep stopping changing the colours.
Yeah. And do we have any idea of the proprietary nature of the device? Has anybody helped you to check the interface, whether between the programming device and the device itself that we can see what the control is?
No, they haven't, but the bit that I'm really interested in, it does. I'm not so worried about the brother part, because the brother will take open digital pattern types.
Yeah.
So the key is to be able to convert any form of graphic into any pattern form which this this machine will load.
And is there any information, so you're saying there's an open format for that it will accept, and is that specification is known, is it?
It is known. There's an open stitch format, but I just don't have the software at the moment that will create that open stitch format.
So what you're looking for is somebody who will take a JPEG image and convert it into a stitch format.
Exactly.
And that both of those standards should be available. So if there's any hackers out there, especially listening to Hacker Public Radio and feel the need to contribute back to the community, could do so by writing that piece of software and gaining the fame and fortune that goes along with it. Well, not so much fortune, but definitely the fame.
Definitely a bit of the fame, and of course I'd be willing to take part in that development as well as a software developer, but it's just not something that I could do entirely on my own.
Yeah, gotcha. Tell me, what is where can I find this for information about this format so I can put it into the show notes?
Well,
where can I find more information about this whole project, in actual fact?
Okay, well, the website for my project at the moment is just a basic one, which is stitchdigital.co.uk.
That's stitchdigital.co.uk.
Yeah, and essentially that's just a small website at the moment, which is to promote the purchasing of garments and having them customized, but I intend to expand that website, which will have information about what I'm looking for and what I want to get involved in with the file formats and the stitch formats and so on. But essentially the net is your friend, and you can just go in and look for stitch formats and open formats and so on.
Okay. Hi, this is Ken again here up at the hardware section of OGCamp 12, and I'm talking to Beth. Beth, what are you doing up here?
I'm helping people to do upcycling or recycling, so reusing old t-shirts that you don't want to wear anymore or that maybe don't fit you, but you actually still really like the design. So we're changing those t-shirts into bags.
Very nice. Can you take us through sort of what the process might be, bearing in mind this is an audio podcast?
That's fine. Yes, no problem. They had some a variety of t-shirts left over from last year's Og Camp, so yeah, they've let me use them. So we have a normal t-shirt,
yeah,
and what we do is we cut both sleeves off.
Yeah, get that, yeah.
Then we cut the neckline off,
yeah,
but you want to go a little bit lower than your actual t-shirt neckline, because
yep,
remember, you're putting stuff in a bag,
gotcha,
so it's not going to leave a lot of space.
Yeah.
Then if you've got a long t-shirt,
yeah,
you can always chop a bit off the bottom.
Gotcha.
One thing I do say to people is don't put 10 tins of beans in it.
Gotcha.
Jersey stretches, you'd be dragging your t-shirt behind you. Then we turn them inside out, and we pin and then stitch along the bottom,
yeah,
with a zigzag stitch, because a zigzag stitch has a bit more give, like your t-shirt,
yeah,
does.
Yeah, yeah.
We do two layers, and then you turn it back the right way around, and you've got a bag.
Fantastic. Any strap on this bag? Oh, the...
Yeah, I've got one.
Oh, yeah, they... And here's one we made earlier. And, of course, the shoulder straps, I guess, would be the handles of the bag.
Yeah.
That's very, very nice.
Combination of the sleeve hile and the fact that it's already stitched by the manufacturer,
yeah,
at your shoulder seam,
yeah,
means that all you have to stitch. It takes longer with the cutting than actually the stitching of the bottom of the bag.
Yeah, and it's a regular stitch, so pretty much anyone can do it.
Yeah, yeah, it's ideal to do it on a sewing machine because of the strength of the stitch.
Yeah.
You could do it by hand, but you'd need to probably do about four layers and it would take longer. But you could do it in front of telly, I suppose, and just test it.
Why are you here?
Because I like the fact that you can do things for free or for very little money, and I don't see why people should be spending a fortune and throwing old clothes and throwing things out.
What's your name?
Paul Freeman.
Hi Paul, how's it going? Who are you and what are you doing?
So I'm one of the organisers at Does Liverpool. We're a co-working space and makerspace based on Hanover Street in the middle of town. So it's a space where we, during the day, mostly we have space where you can either have a permanent desk or just do a day's hot desking. We have a group of people who do that, so mostly freelancers and creative sorts. And we also run events like Make a Night, where people can come along and start playing about with things like 3D printing, laser cutting, the Internet of Things type technology like Arduinos, and people can come along and either work on their own projects if they've got something in mind already, come along and just see what other people are doing if they've never encountered it before, and trying to really just build that community and get people to do exciting things and get people excited and give them a space where they can take advantage of that.
And is there many people in your community at all?
Yeah, so we have, in the actual workspace, we have about 9-10 people with permanent desks, another sort of 10 or so who turn up to do hot desking, and then we have probably around sort of 30-40 people who on and off come to the event. So it's slowly growing. It's, you know, it's getting, trying to get more people interested and to know about us and spread that awareness, but we're getting there over time. We have a diverse group of people who are coming in.
Okay, how much is there membership fees? How much is it to join? Or
so the events we run specifically are free. Anybody can come along, and then from the sort of using the space outside the events, we have like a workshop membership, which is £30 a month, and you can come in and use the tools and equipment. Hot desking is £8 a day, and that lets you also use the laser cutter and the 3D printer and stuff as well. And then those of us who have a full-time desk, it's £150 a month, which gives you an address and a space to come in, and all your tea and coffee and electricity and Wi-Fi and all that stuff as well.
Oh, it's quite interesting, actually. It sounds a lot, but you know, if you compare that to comparable office space.
Yeah, and it depends on how you balance it, because we get decent coffee from like Ball Street Coffee. We get really nice coffee. So, I mean, for a day's point of view, like if you spend, you know, buy three coffees in a coffee shop, then that covers that. So, yeah, so it depends on what people are looking for. But for most of us, because we're mostly freelancers who are doing it, so just having somewhere where you can get out the house and sort of sit down and work somewhere in a space where other people are working as well and have some sort of human contact is really sort of...
So even if you were around and you were doing website design, for instance, just get out of the house, do that 9-to-5 feel rather than come and...
Exactly, rather than sort of getting up in your pyjamas and sitting on your kitchen table.
Can you, starting at the other side, can we walk through the desk here and try and describe to our audio-only listeners what's going on?
Okay, so on the end is Bubblino, which is Adrian McCool, Adrian's device, which it's a bubble machine which listens to the internet. So he listens for Bubblino, and today, anytime anybody mentions the hashtag Ogcamp, he blows bubbles.
It is so funny. There will be a picture of all of these things in the show notes, just by the way, for this episode.
And he's definitely a crowd pleaser. Everybody loves bubbles.
How's that run out? I see it's just got some power and an Ethernet cable.
Yeah, so inside is one of these little devices, which is an Arduino.
An Arduino, yes.
And so inside that, he has an Arduino, which listens to, and Adrian's written a service in the back end, basically. And because there's about 10, I think, exist in the world, different people have bought them. And he connects this web service and basically says, is there a new tweet? And if there's a new tweet, he blows the walls.
Fantastic. Okay, the next one, whichever one you want to pick.
So this is the RFID drum. Yep. And basically, every time you give it an RFID card, so your bank card if it's contactless, or an Oyster card, say.
Yep. That's a public transport card for people out in the States.
Yep. It will play a unique tune to that card. So every card it gets will play. If you represent it and you come back a month later, it'll play your special tune.
Do you want to try it there?
Yeah.
Where's the audio coming
out? It's that, and that.
Okay. And that noise is made by a little mechanical spring mechanism that jumped on a biscuit tin, on a wooden box, and on the tabletop.
Yeah, so they're called solenoids. It's a solenoid, which is basically, it gives a ping when a charge goes over it.
Super. Moving on?
Yeah. And then, so these are some 3D printed sort of artifacts. So we've got a 3D printer, which we've used. So some of these are, you know, you basically get a 3D model, and you
looks remarkably like a castle.
This one's a castle, yeah. We've also done things like, when we did the office, we recently expanded into a workshop. Yeah. So we have scale models of all our furniture, and a laser cut floor plan, and we could rearrange the furniture to work out where everything's going to go to scale.
Okay, now you've justified it to me. Right up until that, it was like, you guys have too much time and money.
Yeah. And then, so moving on to the next one. So the next one is John McCarroll's Weir Dial, Which,
and this is a, just hold on 1 second, I'll try and describe this. It's a circular disc with cogs on the inside, and there's a cog, a small cog on the top, which obviously rotates it, and we've got airport, cafe, pub, station, etc. going around. And what does that do?
That plugs into the service MapMeAt, so MapMe.at, and it looks up somebody's location and displays it in a, on the wheel. So very much like the Weasley fucking Harry Potter.
Excellent, just going there, yeah.
Yes. So yeah, it's one of those examples which if you've read the book, that's exactly what it does. If you've not, does it help? But yeah, it's a visual way of plugging into the internet and telling you where somebody is.
Was that done with a laser cutter than the cogs?
Yes. So it's an all laser cut sort of layout.
And you're not afraid of laser cutting wood?
Oh, laser cutting wood is beautiful. It works really well.
I mean, it looks pretty, but yeah. You're not worried that it'll go on fire or anything?
It does occasionally catch on fire. We have a very sophisticated fire suppression system, which is a jug of water underneath it. But it's... laser cutting...
You're killing me.
Laser cutting is basically incinerating stuff very quickly. But actually, things like wood and plastics are much more tolerant. Corrugated cardboard is the one which we've had the biggest problem with because of the corrugation traps air quite nicely, which makes it combustible. Yeah. But you're
combustible. They say there are a few stories behind that one.
But you're doing a very small amount, and it's in, you know, people building laser cutters are very well aware of the fact that it might catch fire. So it's mostly metal.
But it does look very, very pretty now. It's like a brown kind of... graded brown sort of...
And that's actually something which some people, if you can put like masking tape on, and the masking tape will take the singe and you can get a much cleaner cut, but actually most people don't bother with that because people like the sort of the burn, the burn sort of aesthetic.
Okay, walking on.
And then
a fruit bowl by the looks of it.
Yep, and this one uses a technique called living hinge, which I think we take this one. So this...
I've seen this,
Basically, you're taking something solid, cutting it a lot, and that gives you the really nice bending effect. Which
so if I can describe that to the listeners on the podcast, it's a bit like an accordion. So we've got lots of slits, but there is interjoining hinges in between. That isn't describing it very well. It's a bit like loads of H's one after the other.
Yes.
Okay. Cool. Yeah, very fantastic. Yeah, so this and the fruit bowl is basically a flat piece that has been, wedges have been cut out of it, and there's those interleaving leaves, and it's folded up on each other to form a fruit bowl. Very, very pretty. Oh yes. So then there's what's this joint called here? The key joint, I think. So we got a key joint. Again, the interlock to each other, two different pieces being put together to form a three-dimensional shape, more like a sort of little box, actually, that folds over, which you could no doubt would glue together. Photos for all this will be in the show notes of the episode. Yeah, that's very pretty.
And then these are just...
So we're looking at here a little design of two birthday cakes. So the outline of the birthday cake is done with a candle in it, but engraved into that is the pattern of the cake. I didn't think it was possible to not cut the whole way through.
Oh no, so you can do what engraving. So basically when you're setting up the software for it, you control two things. One is the speed it moves at, and one is the intensity of the cut. And so you can move either by moving very quickly over the surface or by doing very low power. You can basically get the software to fill in a space. And that's where it becomes a bit of a black art because every material is a bit different. So it's the cutting of the shape is absolutely millimeter precise, but the how much you cut and the intensity you cut is a bit of a black art. You get a feeling and you think, this I'll cut really quickly at a 50%. And see how that turns out. And that's where it gets to the artistry in sort of taking something and think, I want this to be really dark, so I'm going to go really, really strong, fairly slow, but you know that one setting cuts it, so you say, well, I'll go twice at speed, so hopefully it'll only cut half the way through.
I must say there, we're now entering into definitely the realm of art here. You know, none of these pieces will be out of place in somebody's house.
Yeah, I mean, we get the people who are interested in sort of using the kit. It's definitely much more artists wanting to produce their artwork rather than, I guess, techies wanted to be artistic. It's definitely people are sort of seeing, yeah, I've seen these techniques used somewhere else, and an artist, I've got an idea, help me do it. And that's where we're really sort of finding the more interest. I think techies turning to artists is quite difficult, because as a techie, once you know how it works, you're happy.
Yeah, job done.
Yep. Whereas artists actually always have grand ideas, which can be realized really simply. Because it's like, even things like Bubblino is a very simple example of the technology switching something on and off with a really nice enclosure. And that whole smoke and mirrors of, if you've got a simple idea but scale it up big, lots of artists get that and can sort of hook into that really easily. You can teach them really basic skills with the sort of available technology, and they can do something really grand with it.
It's fantastic. And this big LED strip thing, it reminds me a bit of an LED strip I want for the house.
Yeah, so this is they're individually programmable LEDs, so each one of those can be programmed separately.
Is that normal, or, you know, if I was to buy one of these in the hardware store just as a lighting, is that normal that you can individually program them?
It gives you a lot more options. Because the actual strip itself has the circuitry in it, it saves you a lot of manually wiring. You could produce the same thing with an Arduino and a big pile of LEDs. But then you get to the point where, how much soldering do you actually want to do?
Although Mr. X has done a good episode on introduction to soldering here on Hacker Public Radio, but...
Yeah, but it's one of those things... Yeah, this is what a really good example of. Sometimes you just want lots of lights to work really simply. Yeah. And it looks nice on front of the desk.
And is this like... So what I wanted to know is, if I go down to the local hardware store, is this what I get if I ask for a strip of LEDs?
I think this is a bit more intelligent in that I think you can. There's a lot more control over the individuality of them.
Okay. For the listeners listening, it's a strip about 2 meters long, about 2 yards or so, and it's every inch or so, 25 centimeters. There's a LED, and essentially the blue box at the end is controlling different colors. And what are they doing with this other than just displaying nice colours?
They just display nice colours. Sometimes
that's all it takes.
It's one of those things. It's like, that's just what it says on the tin.
It is fantastic. And listen, if somebody wanted to become a member of your community, get involved, where do we send them?
So we have two websites, doesliverpool.com, doesliverpool.com. And
what does that stand for?
Do epic shit.
You heard it here, folks. And the other website?
Is makeanite.co.uk.
Okay. Is that in any way linked to O'Reilly's and their thing?
No, it's all our own brand, as it were.
And what's this thing on? I just completely forgot here. On the corner, there appears to be a pencil or a pen on a whiteboard that has a piece of paper on it. And there are two wires, essentially, pulling it up and down. The left one pulls it up, the right one pulls it down. And it is drawing from... It's basically drawing a picture. This is the weirdest thing I've ever seen. There will be a picture in the show notes. Talk to me.
Okay, so this is a drawbot. We've assembled it.
Of course it is.
I can't remember the guy who made it. We've got it as a kit, and other people can buy them. We'll have some links on the website about it. But basically, the drawbot is two stepper motors which have strings attached to them, and by moving those strings, it has a little raft, and the pen comes down and takes the image. It's an image uploaded into the program, and it draws things.
And it looks suspiciously like as if the components were manufactured using a laser cutter.
I believe they were. Yes.
Listen, this has been absolutely fantastic. Have you found that, like, recently there seems to be a massive move into the whole hardware hacking place?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think especially 3D printing, people, oh, there's some really nice 3D printers coming out. People are really getting excited by it, I guess, is the thing. And people are sort of starting to sort of be able to play with it. So everything's always known it sounds cool, but now people can actually buy something out of reasonably affordable price and put it on their desk and play with it. And especially as a group, you can get something and actually get your hands on it.
It's fantastic. Thank you very much for taking the tour. And now just going to take some photos of everything so we have it in for the show notes. Thank you very much. Okay, hi, my name is Ken Fallon. I'm up here at the hardware section of OnCam 12. And I'm talking to?
My name is Zachary DeSantos.
How are you doing? And what are you doing here?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm Very excited. I'm doing, trying to get as much data from this kite today as I can. I've bought various methods of getting data. I've got the focus for this weekend are these stretch sensors.
Sorry, let's take a walk back because this is an audio podcast. I'm sitting at the bench. You've got a whole go of wires in front of you, and what should I be looking at?
Right, this piece of elastic.
Yeah.
It's I had this idea 3 years ago, and I looked up stretch sensors online, and I got a lot of corporations, and it was.
What's a stretch sensor?
A stretch.
Stretch sensor.
And
what does a stretch sensor do, and why would you need one?
This is measuring displacement or stretch. So this is a piece of elastic, just like a broken elastic band.
Yeah.
And if I hold both ends and pull, it stretches.
Yeah.
And it's conductive. So if I put it into a simple circuit with another resistor, when I stretch this piece of elastic, it lets less voltage through.
Okay, where are we going with this?
Measurement and send it to the computer. And then I can then send that via a XB radio transmitter device through a serial port into a Python script, which then sends the data into another module, which sends OSC, Open Sound Control, which I can listen to on my sound software, essentially turning this piece of elastic into a slider on the music software.
Okay, and why would you do this?
So I built, what I'm building is, I fly dual line delta kites, and I've got two handles.
You fly a kite?
It's a sports kite.
Yeah.
It's a stunt kite.
So we're talking about a physical thing that a child might fly in the air, only more complex.
It's the thing that children are fascinated, and then adults come back to after they retire from their busy, crazy jobs. They remember their childhood, and then they go back to their kites. Or some, I don't know many people that have been on kites their whole life and not had a break, but a lot of people go back to it after they've had a childhood, beautiful childhood experience. And then realize that kites is the way forward.
Okay. So on the table, there'll be a picture of all this stuff in the show notes, don't worry. So on the table, there's a kite. Yeah. So what we've got is a piece of stretchy elastic band that broadcasts to the kite. Am I right?
Yeah, essentially, the elastic band is built into my kite handle. There's a spring on that so that it doesn't stretch too much. There's a limiting rope on it so it doesn't overstretch.
Yeah.
I'm getting data which is based on, is the kite pulling, or am I, when I add a pulse to the kite by pulling my hand, it will give me a spike in the data.
Yeah.
That data is going on the XB Series 1. It's configured as a wireless cable.
Yeah.
So it literally sends the voltage data from analog to a digital converter that sends the signal to the other XB Series 1, which is plugged by USB into the computer.
Yeah.
And then the Python script reads the serial monitor of the data and looks for two strings, kite line 1 and kite line 2. There's two data floats.
Okay. And what do you do with those?
So far, I've got a few modules that I've built. I'm using a bit of software called TX Modular, which is written within SuperCollider. SuperCollider is open source, massive piece of software that people use to make various interactive things.
Yeah.
And the TX Modular has been written to make it easier for people to code without being able to use coding language and programming language. So you've got quite low level modules, and in a way you are coding still, but you're using things like sequencers to sequence events, analyzers that analyze your data and give you and convert that into other floats. such as sliders that can control samplers, or they can control via OSC, Open Sound Control, they can control graphical, manipulate graphical controls.
Yeah.
So I see it as like puppeteering on the software. You're sending a lot of different floats. So I've got two strings on my kite.
Yeah.
I'm trying, those two strings are like two puppet strings that I can control loads of stuff on the computer.
Okay, so you're actually flying a kite, and in the process of flying a kite, you're doing something on the computer.
Yeah.
What's that something on the computer?
Today, I've got a grid of 25 squares. If you imagine a grid, 5x5, in each square, there's a sample. So you can navigate those five squares like you would navigate a map, with a simple dot. So if you move the dot to the top left, you're in square one. Yeah. So it's like having a joystick. If you had a joystick, you could move around the squares. You could move your position.
You essentially built the world's biggest mouse.
Yeah, it's a flying mouse. Yeah. Like, it's not going to be a flying mouse in the future.
Yes, well, that mouse could do cool interactive things.
I actually built the sampler for having a Wii controller on my head.
Yeah.
The reason why I built that grid is so I could move my head forward slightly and I would go to the beach. Move my head backwards and I'd go to the trees, virtual reality trees. Move my head left and I could go to the shopping center. So I'd put samples of a map in this grid. And I had a Wii controller with its accelerometers. And if I move my head left, the action sequencer would tell your position on the map to move slowly to the left. So it's like a slow mouse for your head. I've grabbed those modules and that code, and I'm going to rearrange it for the kite. What I've got here,
looking at a pair of old-fashioned goggles that one might. Seriously, the more I'm talking to you, I'm wondering: are you a genius, or are you completely insane, or both? Anyway, it's a pair of old rethink severe mental illness. Yes, appropriate. I see a pair of 1920s goggles that someone might ride with a sports car, with some sort of webcam type of thing in the front. Is it a webcam?
It's a simple webcam. This is like...
With elastic bands, by the way.
Clunky thing. I actually got these goggles in an anime conference. My girlfriend took me to my first anime conference, and it was loads and loads of people, and they were all dressed up in anime costumes and things. And they had a marketplace, and I found these goggles, and I thought, you know, like, these are what I'm looking for, because they've got foam in them, and I can cut into the foam and add a webcam. So that's why I got them. Mm. So there's a problem with webcams outdoors. When there's sun shining, in fact, there's a lot of problems, because the variables are massive, because the sun changes throughout the day. So essentially, this camera the software that is analyzing this camera, and it's looking for a particular color. That color is lime green, because my main kite is completely lime green. I had it customized in totally lime green. I shouldn't have chosen lime green, because it's nearly the color of grass, it's nearly the color of the trees, but I just chose that color. I need to get a black one. I added this red lens to this webcam out of 3D glasses, because I read online that it would get rid of some of the glare. And it does. You see a great picture, but everything is lime green. So my kite is invisible.
Kind of defeats the purpose, unfortunately. Okay.
If I had a black kite, that would be ideal, because everything else is lime green. So that would turn the kite into the joystick that I've shown you, that would navigate my map. And that's why I built that map. But I've got to kind of hack my own program, because I've got two stretch sensors instead of a joystick. It's totally different. And also, when you fly a kite and you do stunts, this is a stunt kite, you're doing a lot of jerky, fast movements, slow, graceful movements, where it's a massive range of movements.
Yeah.
And what I'm hoping to do in the future is get my data so clean that I can record a palette of different things a kite can do, as a gesture, as a signature, a bit like voice recognition. And I'm using Bruno Zambulli from Erkam University. I've got his patch that recognizes gestures, and when you repeat a gesture, the computer will follow you. So it sets a timeline to your gestures. Say I do like a circle with my hand, and it's following my hand. It will say, right, you're doing a circle with your hand. It normally took you 30 seconds to move your hand in a full circle. So we've got 30 seconds and we'll follow you as you move your hand around, and the computer will follow you. So hopefully I can get the computer to follow the kite as it moves around, and I'll have some significant recognition patterns. This is not going to happen this weekend. This is a long-term project. But the idea is to make a palette of all the different movements a kite can do. And then that palette will have a set of actions that can control sounds and visual things.
It is amazing what you're doing.
Thank you.
It is, some would say, completely pointless, but no, actually, I think you're onto something.
Thank you.
I don't know exactly what it is.
Well, I mean, I grew up in southeast London near Blackheath. They had Blackheath Kite Festival, and they do a lot of choreography for these kites. And normally they fly the kites to music. So this is within that community. It's making the music fly to the kites.
Very, very nice. Okay, now I get it. Finally, I see. I see the vision of your ways. Congratulations. Thank you very much. I appreciate the interview.
Thank you. Thanks for the interview.
Hi, this is Ken again up here at Odd Camp 12. We're up at the hardware hacking section. And as I walked along, this gentleman was waving a piece of electronic aperture in the air. Hi, how are you? What's your name and what are you doing here?
Hello, my name's John Chamberlain. I'm from Blackpool Linux User Group, and I'm here today with my fellows just because Arduino is an interest to me. And not recently, not too long ago, I bought one of these kind of Arduino open source kits, the Nanode, which is a UK built Arduino clone. And I'm building that with my son, and I was just looking to get some ideas today for projects that we can kind of work on.
Okay, as I'm looking here, I see a Arduino, as you'll know from Hacker Public Radio previous episodes. And on one side, and on the other side, you've got a breadboard of some sort with the LEDs sticking out. So what's the plan?
So what this is, there are various kind of projects for Arduino, and the simplest one is just a flashing LED. And that's fine, that's kind of a test. It's like the hello world of the Arduino. And there are various variations on that, but what this is what's called a persistence of vision circuit. And what it is, and whether you've seen those things that people attach to their bike wheels, and as the bike wheel spins, it writes out a message like hello or whatever. Or
yeah, you see them at the airports and stuff as they spin around in a disc.
Exactly. So this is the Arduino take on that. Yeah. So it's a very hand-drawn one, because you kind of this is great for radio, but I've got a piece of breadboard with a whole bunch of wires and LEDs just inserted into holes, and then wired, lashed up to the Arduino that's next to it. And then I've got a USB cable going from the Arduino into the back of my laptop. And then I've got the code running on here, and essentially it downloads a program that displays a message in a persistence of vision format, which means that you actually have to move the LEDs to see the message, because all you'll see when it's static is a bunch of flashing LEDs that don't show you anything.
So okay, let's try it out here.
Well, I have to say my wire is full on it, so I'm just going to go back and plug my wire back in.
And while you're doing that, I'll turn on the video so we have some video to go along with this. If nothing else, there's going to be an element of comedic value associated with this.
Comedic value is the thing, actually. Yes. Now let's have a look. That's there. Oh, here we go. So one of them's not working, actually, but I've got six LEDs flashing. So you see, they're kind of what looks like when it's static, randomly flashing.
Yeah.
And you just come to me as I've just finished building it. So this is at the alpha stage.
Okay, enough excuses. Make it work.
No promises. Okay. So to introduce the element of motion into it, to make it a persistence of vision, you have to move the circuit board, because on the board.
I'm seeing something.
Can you see something? I think. Oh, there's
followed.
This is the prototyping phase. So the next stage is once you've proved the concept, we moved to the soldering stage. We transfer these bits of wire on a breadboard to some actual, it's gone now, a bit of circuit board and solder it so that you can wave it around and the wires don't fall out. But I think if I go fast enough, you'll see there is a word there.
It's S-E, it's a four-letter word. It's S-E-O-C or something.
The two words, let's have a look.
Two words?
Two words, sounds like. There's one or two. This Snoot Lab is one that's encoded in there, and the other is Rules.
Okay. Snoot Lab's Rules, right.
Snoot Lab, have we seen there?
I'm desperately trying to. I see Rules. I definitely saw Rules, yeah.
I think it needs to be on a bicycle.
As we were watching that, one of the wires was flying across the room.
The joy of prototyping.
I said, thank you very much for taking the time. I appreciate it. Okay. The video will be on the website. Okay, thank you. Hi everybody, my name is Ken Fallon and I'm up here at the hardware section and I've come across somebody that you might know. What's your name and what are you doing here?
It's Pete Lomas from the Raspberry Pi Foundation and I'm here because this is a hardware hack day. I'm an engineer, I've been involved in engineering all my life and it's absolutely fantastic to be here and see so many young and not so young people getting involved in hacking hardware.
And when you say you're involved in Raspberry Pi, can you be a little bit more clear to our listeners?
Yeah, I took the reference designs that Broadcom had actually given us, and I ended up turning out the final design of Raspberry Pi that you now can buy.
So you're one of the team who are physically working on the Raspberry Pi project?
Yeah, I'm one of the trustees, and we work, you know, probably a day a week on Raspberry Pi. I have a day job as well, which I have to do. Yeah, no, we're actively working on it. I'm based up here in Warrington. The rest of the team are over in Cambridge. But hey, that's not a problem with modern communications.
Not at all. So what happened? You had a dream one morning, you woke up and decided you wanted to change the face of computing for everybody?
Well, no, it was really, for me, it was to change the face of hardware hacking, actually getting something that kids could get involved with and they could actually try and make things that involved electronics. Now, I'd been to Imperial College to actually see a demonstration of a product that my company had built, and I bumped into Alan Mycroft, who is also now one of the trustees of Raspberry Pi. We got talking, and the rest, I think we say, is history. We just had a total synergy of objective of what we were trying to do, which was to get children from all walks of life to actually fire their imagination into electronics and computing and programming, and get them involved and really try and make that a career for them so then they would consider a career in computer engineering or computer science or electronics at university.
Have you been kind of floored by the phenomenon that is the Raspberry Pi?
Yeah, I think there was a comment that said my gast has never been so flabbered. I mean, you know, we planned to make a few hundred initially and then maybe a few thousand. And, you know, we had a, I won't say we had tunnel vision, but we had a very good focus on what we were trying to achieve. And then it just exploded. I mean, that's highly thanks to Liz, who did some sterling work on our website and publicized what we were doing. And Eben seemed to get his face almost on every TV program. And it just escalated from there. But I think in a good way, because not only has it promoted Raspberry Pi, I think it's promoted the whole concept of small computers and the ability to actually build things with small computers and achieve something novel. And some of the things that we've seen are just absolutely fantastic. Now, I absolutely take my hat off to some of the people who've designed things. They're so inspired, and that's what it's all about, is inspiring people to do things. And if in some small way we've achieved that, that is absolutely brilliant.
I think we said it before and we said it again here when I was talking to Clash and did an episode on the Raspberry Pi. It's all about the connectors. It's all about the connectors.
It is. I mean, it's all about, I think, for me, it's all about having that access to the GPIO and being able to get into the heart of the system very, very easily. You know, connecting something to the USB is all read very well, but it's not quite as immediate. And as I've said in my talk, you know, a massive ecosystem has now evolved to actually support those connectors, to build things onto those connectors. And so, as I was also saying, it now gives me a bit of a legacy problem. If I start moving things around, you know, it's gonna corrupt the ecosystem. So we're gonna have to be very careful how we go forward. And it just adds another challenge to the
And what is the, you know, do you have any scoops? What's the plans? Are you going to evolve the board?
The plan is, I mean, we're going to evolve the board in terms of doing the educational release. That is something that we are very focused on. But as I've said, you know, there's possibilities that once it all becomes completely open source, then other Pi-esque ecosystems will occur with other board designs, not necessarily done by the foundation. But that doesn't matter. What really matters is that it's galvanized people into action and are actually doing something. Because whatever they do, whether it's, you know, with a Pi, whether it's with an Arduino, a Nanobone, I don't think that makes any difference. The fact that they're doing it is the most important thing.
I must say, as a mechanical engineer who slaved over a board for my final thesis project, it was working up in the lab, and they moved it down to the main hall, and wires went loose, and it never worked afterwards. You are a god to all of us who has made this whole thing so simple. From everybody here, thank you very much. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
No, I think it's great. I'm looking forward. This is obviously day one of OggCamp. I'm looking forward to day two. Hopefully we can meet a lot more people, and that'll be great. Well, so far I've really enjoyed it, and I've got no reason to think that that's going to stop. So I just say thanks for having me, and thanks for the invite.
And just, was it a conscious decision to go with your distributors, the fact that it goes through RS and who's the other supplier? Farnell. Was that a conscious decision? Did that kind of...
It was a conscious decision. It was a hard decision. We sat there and we were talking on the telephone, and we sat there and we thought about it. I mean, we were in a situation where we had 100,000 people wanting a Raspberry Pi, beating the path to the website and saying, when can we have it? When can we have it? So we had two choices. We could have kept it in the foundation. We could have worked at it as best we could. We could have kept it completely open source, and we could have delivered the product probably 1,000 a month, 2,000, then maybe 4,000, because we'd have had to get funding, we'd have had to make arrangements with suppliers, all that sort of detail that you perhaps don't think about. And we've also had to set up a worldwide distribution. So we looked at it and we said, well, now, why are we doing these guys? They are at the top of their game, but what do we have to give away? Well, not unreasonably, we have to give away something, and that was give them some exclusivity to actually get back some of their investment.
No big deal.
Well, no, I don't think it is a big deal. I said, you know, without them, I don't think Raspberry Pi would be on the planet in the way it is today. And I don't think what the ecosystem has now created as a result of them being there would be there today. So they're absolutely instrumental in what we've achieved. And they know that ultimately we want to take it open source, because that was always the aim. And they're fully behind that. But, you know, they're just going to say, well, come on, guys, let's do our bit first. I think that's only fair.
Not a problem. By happy coincidence, you know that every school, college, engineering workshop in the world has one of these, has an account with these guys, and the technicians can simply order this as they're ordering the resistors and the capacitors, and just making it easier for the students to buy it without having to get any budget signed off.
Well, that's right. I mean, it probably would come, you know, they're so cheap they are under the radar, I guess, but I mean, I couldn't possibly suggest that people buy them that way. What they need to do is put their own money on the table and buy them. And the other thing, of course, is they are cheap enough to break. You don't worry really about breaking a Raspberry Pi. I mean, you try not to. When they were really, really rare, you didn't go near it. People were handling them with kid gloves. That wasn't the intention. The intention was to get there, get stuck in, and if the worst happens, it's only the same cost as a trip to the Pizza Hut or something.
You You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All BinRev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Share Alike, 3.0 license.